regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
employees. The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's virtual fireside chat with FTC Commissioner Christine Wilson. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion on today's program are those of our guests. Today, we're excited to bring you a great discussion about regulatory reform, privacy and antitrust, and I'm sure much more. Our moderator today is Svetlana Ganz. Svetlana serves as Vice President and Associate General Counsel at NCTA, where she advances NCTA's policy positions on competition, privacy, and advertising issues before federal agencies and Congress. Previously, Svetlana served as the FTC Chief of Staff under FTC Acting Chairman Maureen Olhausen. In this role, she oversaw agency operations, executed strategic initiatives, including regulatory and process reforms, and served as a key advisor on consumer protection and competition policy and enforcement matters. Svetlana is a frequent speaker on privacy and antitrust topics, including on FTC process and procedures. She serves on the council of the ABA Antitrust Section and several of the Federal Society's practice groups, including RTP's Antitrust and Consumer Protection Working Group. If you'd like to learn more about both of our guests today, you can visit our website, regproject.org. That's regproject.org, where we have their complete bios. In a second, I'll turn it over to Svetlana, who will introduce the commissioner and help guide the conversation. After their discussion, we will go to audience Q&A, so please think about the questions you'd like to ask of the commissioner. Questions can be submitted by those who have joined us via the Zoom webinar. And to ask a question, you simply send it to us via the chat function at the bottom of your screen. With that, Svetlana and Commissioner Wilson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much, Nate, for that nice introduction. It's great to be here. Before we begin, I'd like to say thank you to Nate and his staff, as well as to Commissioner Wilson and her staff for all your work in preparation for this fireside chat. Today, we are privileged to have Commissioner Wilson with us today. Commissioner Wilson was sworn in as an FTC commissioner on September 26, 2018. Commissioner Wilson previously served as the FTC Chief of Staff under Chairman Tim Mures during the Bush administration. When nominated, Commissioner Wilson was serving as Senior Vice President at Delta Airlines. And prior to joining Delta, Commissioner Wilson was in private practice at Kirkland & Ellis and O'Melveny & Myers. Commissioner Wilson has written extensively on antitrust in digital markets, healthcare, privacy, regulatory reform, agency transparency, and regulatory parity. We are thrilled to have her with us today. Thank you so much for being here, Commissioner Wilson.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Svetlana, and also thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Thanks so much. So, Commissioner Wilson, you've had broad experiences both in private practice and in-house. Can you tell us how those and other life experiences have shaped your approach as a commissioner?
Sure, absolutely. So I would like to tell the story that I told at my confirmation hearing, and I've also told it a couple of other times. So please bear with me for those of you who might have heard the story. I'm sure Svetlana has. So I would say the pivotal moment in my life in terms of choosing the career that I have pursued and shaping my outlook was a trip that I took with my mother through Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union when I was in high school. I was 14 years old. It was 1984. It was before the Iron Curtain fell. And my mother and I traveled with a group and our in-tourist guides. There was no unaccompanied travel. We also frequently had KGB tales. And it was a fascinating experience because I got to see firsthand the misery and deprivation and long lines and empty shelves that you get in a command and control economy. And I would say one of the most vivid memories for me was traveling by bus through first the West Germany countryside and then the East Germany countryside. And when you're traveling, you see in West Germany, manicured fences and fields and painted buildings, and everything is weeded and beautifully maintained. And then when you get to East Germany, suddenly the fences are ramshackle, the buildings are falling down, they're not painted, the tractors and the other equipment are rusty, and weeds are everywhere. And so you can see immediately, in a very vivid way, from a 14-year-old perspective, the incentives that are established by the kind of economic system that you have. And for me, that was just an incredibly revealing trip. I was only behind the Iron Curtain for 3 weeks, but it was during a very formative period in my life. And that was when I realized I wanted to live in a place where market forces could flourish and where the government had an incredibly light hand when it came to anything with respect to the economy.
Thank you for that story. As you know, I was born in Belarus, so it brings me back to my days there as well. So can you tell us how those and other experiences have shaped your views on the free market economy generally?
Sure. So as I returned from the Soviet Union, I was moving into high school. I started participating in the debate team. I did extemporaneous speaking, and a lot of the topics there had to do with current events. And so I maintained an interest and a fluency with what was happening with respect to governments around the world and economies around the world. And at the time, my mother was also getting her MBA moving on to a PhD in economics. And so I was just very drawn to the field of economics and the way that it impacted the everyday lives of people depending on the system that had been established around them. And so when I went to college, I continued taking economics classes and then eventually ended up taking antitrust law and economics, a graduate level class as an undergrad, and said, this is the field that I want to practice in for the rest of my life. And when I started practicing antitrust law, I began to assist clients who were dealing with heavy-handed regulatory regimes and saw in a very real way that the costs that are imposed and the stifling of innovation that occurs. And when I moved from being outside counsel to actually serving in-house as executive vice president at Delta Airlines in the legal department, I saw in even a more concrete way, 17 layers deeper, the incredible costs that are imposed, frequently with very little benefit. And so, yes, obviously we want airlines to be safe. We want them to protect their passengers. We want to be sure that the incentives are correct for the airlines to do that. But the question is, at what point are you regulating just to regulate? And frankly, there were a lot of regulations in the airline industry that had stayed on the books, had far outlived their utility, stifled innovation, and imposed substantial costs, but created absolutely no benefit for consumers. And so when the Trump administration came in, the DOT said, please tell us all of the regulations you think we should revisit and roll back. And that was a great opportunity to go through all of those heavy-handed regulations that served no purpose. And so I would say from the perspective of counseling clients and from serving in-house, my understanding of the impact these regulations have, well-intentioned though they may be, has really shaped the perspective I bring to rulemaking at the FTC.
So that feeds well into my next question. I want to touch a little bit on the regulatory reform at the commission. So as you just mentioned, you're a huge proponent of deregulation. The FTC has recently modified or rescinded some rules like the picture rule and the nursery guides rule, and reviews most of its regulations on a 10-year cycle to ensure that they are still serving their original purpose. Why are these regulatory rule reviews important, and what more would you like the FTC to be doing with respect to deregulation?
So I do think it's beneficial for the FTC to conduct these routine reassessments of the rules to ensure that as technology changes, the rules remain relevant. So for example, you mentioned the picture tube rule. Televisions don't have picture tubes anymore. And so it was obviously just appropriate and sensible to roll back that rule. It's also a good opportunity to reassess the cost-benefit analysis. Are the benefits of these rules still outliving the costs that are imposed? And so, and there are a couple of rules that I think, frankly, do serve a very good purpose. So for example, the funeral rule, and it is out for comment again now. And when you're talking about circumstances in which people are grieving and they are vulnerable and they may not be thinking in the most rational way, the funeral rule provides, I think, good protection for them. And based on a couple of experiences in my life, I believe that that's actually a very good rule to have in place. But there are other rules. So for example, the energy labeling rule. Shortly after I arrived at the commission, we put that rule out for comment. And this is a rule that provides guidance on labeling for appliances. And so industry is supposed to identify the energy consumption of the different appliances, and labels are affixed to allow consumers to have the information to make informed purchasing decisions. And as I read through the rule to determine whether I would vote to put this out for comment, I came across a portion that said the labels that are printed to be affixed to the appliances should weigh, you should print them on paper that is 58 pounds per 500 sheets of paper. And you should use X and Y minimum adhesive peel capacity to affix these labels to the appliances. And I thought, you know, I did not learn about the appropriate weight of paper to be used for labels or the appropriate minimum adhesive peel capacity to affix labels to appliances when I was in law school. I'm not quite sure why the FTC thinks that it's comparative advantage to be establishing these standards. And so I asked if we could put out for notice and comment whether we really needed these provisions. And first time around, the answer was no. And so I wrote a dissent. And I said, I really don't think this is our comparative advantage. I think that we can tell industry, this is the information that needs to be on the label, because that's what Congress directed the FTC to do from a statutory perspective. They told us to establish the content of the labels. And we can leave that to them and then say we should be sure that the labels are easy to read and affixed relatively permanently to the appliances, and you know, sort of be done with the job that Congress gave us, because obviously we have to fulfill that mandate. And so I dissented when that approach was not taken, but we recently put out the rule again for notice and comment. And I again raised the question of whether we could ask the public whether it would be okay to dispense with those provisions as too highly prescriptive, and could we give industry a little more flexibility and latitude to choose for itself the kinds of labels they thought would be sufficiently sturdy and affixed to the appliances to serve their purpose. And so that is the approach that the commission has taken second time around. And so if you are interested in the topic, I welcome you to go and take a look at the docket and my first dissent, in which I explained my chagrin and horror that the FTC was unfortunately harking back to the 1970s and essentially serving as a national nanny, which I don't think the industry needs.
So following up on that, the FTC has historically emphasized a flexible and technology-neutral approach to regulating privacy and data security, asking companies to implement reasonable safeguards tailored to company-specific risk profile. However, recent cases and proposed rulemaking suggest that the commission may be moving into a more prescriptive posture, as you indicated with the labeling, to mandate specific technological practices. What is driving this shift, and do you believe this is the right approach with respect to data and privacy?
So I think there are two issues. First is with respect to consent decrees that we obtained during the course of settling potential lawsuits with respondents. And the issue that arises there is from an 11th Circuit decision in a case called LabMD. The FTC was dinged in that opinion for having unconstitutionally vague guidance regarding what an appropriate and reasonably comprehensive data security program would be. And so we use terms like reasonable, and the court thought that that was unconstitutionally vague. And so you will see, beginning with our dealer-built consent and moving forward, much more prescriptive language about what we mean when we say we want a comprehensive data security program for a company that has actually been found to have flawed data security. And so because of LabMD, we are becoming more prescriptive in our settlements and in our consents. And it is a necessity, but this is for a universe of companies that have already failed to provide appropriate data security. And so that is one category that we're doing out of necessity, and that frankly, if Congress passed data security legislation, we could dispense with. The second issue is what we're seeing in at least one of our rules. In the safeguards rule, which was enacted pursuant to Gramm-Leach-Bliley, we had previously used reasonable type language, and we put out for notice and comment again with dissenting views of Commissioner Noah Phillips and me, a much more prescriptive set of obligations for companies. And we dissented for probably three or four different reasons. First of all, we think it's the wrong time. Congress has been actively working on privacy legislation. In the past, it has worked on data security legislation. With all of the high-profile breaches that we've seen and with the settlement of the Equifax case, we hope that Congress will move ahead with data security legislation. And in that instance, what we're doing now would be preempted by that. Second of all, it is incredibly prescriptive. And I think this is moving away from the trend that was established when Chairman Tim Muris in the early 2000s started bringing privacy and data security cases. We didn't want to be prescriptive. We know that technology evolves. We understand that it is the companies on the front lines who are dealing with these issues on a day in, day out basis who are best situated to determine the appropriate approach and employing the technology that is evolving and on the cutting edge and that will provide the best protections for themselves and their systems and their customers. And so for those reasons, we have tried to use language like reasonableness in our privacy and data security program guidance because we don't want to be prescriptive. We don't want people to be locked into the technology of the moment. One other issue with the dissent was that staff took a look at the different instances in which data security breaches could arise and then the fencing in provisions that were used and then put all of that into the draft rule that's been put out for notice and comment. And while we may have fencing in relief that's appropriate for people who have already failed to provide adequate data security, it's not clear that those measures and the attendant costs need to be imposed on all industry across the board when we know that 90-95% of companies have yet to experience a data breach and may never. And so imposing all of those incremental costs on companies is problematic. And so for those reasons, Noah Phillips and I, Commissioner Phillips and I, dissented from the issuance of that rule.
Interesting. So along those lines, you also dissented in the Avant case where you raise in your dissent the notion of regulation by enforcement, which is similar to what you're discussing here in terms of fencing in relief becoming the new normal. So you dissented in that case based on your concerns that the FTC was seen to bootstrap legal theories together and regulate by enforcement rather than going by the letter of the law. Can you describe the issue in that case and what you meant there by regulation by enforcement?
Sure. So it's a pretty technical issue having to do with remotely created checks. And the telemarketing sales rule prohibits the use of remotely created checks, known as RCCs, within the context of telemarketing. But the Electronic Fund Transfer Act considered whether to prohibit RCCs and decided not to. But by first invoking a violation of the TSR to knock out RCCs as a, quote, alternative form of payment under EFTA, we then dinged the respondent for not providing two different potential forms of payment for customers under EFTA. And so it was first finding a violation of the telemarketing sales rule and then saying, and because of that, you have violated EFTA. Now, the company at issue, Avant, actually did not do much more than answer the phone when its customers called. And so I didn't believe, first of all, we had the evidence to support alleged violations under the telemarketing sales rule. But then to bootstrap an EFTA violation because of a telemarketing sales rule violation, which in and of itself, I believe, had incredibly thin evidence, greatly concerned me. The reason that that the FTC was interested in doing this is because they do believe RCCs are a gateway for a lot of fraud. And as a policy matter, the FTC prefers not to see RCCs used, particularly by telemarketers where you do have a lot of fraud. And that is fine. I don't mind a policy that says we disfavor RCCs. But my concern came when we are trying to essentially create precedent that says if you're in this situation, you're not allowed to use RCCs, when in fact, EFTA, again, the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, in its legislative history had considered whether to include RCCs and rejected including those in its ban. And so for that reason, I did dissent from the case and I said, I think if we have concerns about RCCs and we'd like to see that banned in EFTA, we need to go to Congress. If we want to do it here, we can make a rulemaking here at the FTC, but it is not appropriate, particularly in the context of a settlement where respondents are not admitting or denying liability. And we essentially, for better or for worse, have them over a barrel. And so we use the full weight and heft of the federal government with these settling defendants to implement a policy that would be appropriately the subject of legislation or rulemaking, but now is precedent that says RCCs shouldn't be used in these situations.
That's interesting. So kind of touching on the rulemaking theme, recently Commissioner Rohit Chopra wrote an article in March with Lena Khan urging the commission to utilize its unfair methods of competition authority to promulgate competition-based rules. Can you discuss your reaction to that view?
So I think it is a terrible idea. I am not in favor of rulemaking generally. I think rules tend to become more and more complicated and to build over time and to exert more and more of a stifling influence on innovation and competition. And so I generally disfavor rules except in clear cases of market failure. And I particularly disfavor the idea of using rulemaking on the competition side. So what we know is that antitrust law is based on economics. The Supreme Court in Kimball said, we are supposed to look to economics to guide antitrust enforcement. And our analysis and our understanding of economics is continually evolving. And so if we create rules based on our understanding of economics today, those are going to be quickly outpaced as economics continues to evolve. and we will be doing a disservice to vibrant competition based on market forces. Second, when you have rules and regulatory frameworks, companies find ways to game the system. So think about competition in the pharmaceutical industry with branded pharmaceutical companies and generics. The first task, I believe it was the first task that I did at the Federal Trade Commission as a law clerk, was to write a memo assessing all of the different ways that branded manufacturers had attempted to keep generics out of the market. And so this was in 1992 or 1993, and I compiled a 35, it was a beautiful 35-page memo that, of course, you know, you could never do in a law firm. And it analyzed under Section 2 of the Sherman Act all of the different ways that, that branded companies to date had tried to keep generics out of the market. And I have continued to work in the pharmaceutical industry on behalf of generic companies who were seeking to break into the market and who were facing all of these different exclusionary tactics at the hands of branded manufacturers. And we have this conversation at the FTC. Marcus Meyer and the healthcare shop identify one tactic that's being used. They conduct investigations. They go after those companies, and the brands shift to a different tactic, and so on. It is truly a game of whack-a-mole. And if you have a rule that bans one of those tactics, then generics and brands will find themselves doing battle over a different kind of barrier to entry that the brands have erected. And so you will end up in this perpetual rulemaking routine that frankly isn't as flexible as the Sherman Act, which says you're not allowed to create these barriers to entry and monopolize or attempt to monopolize. And so I think for that reason, rulemaking on the competition side is a really bad idea.
Okay, so wanted to do one more question on this general set of topics and then move to privacy. It's almost 12:30. So I wanted to talk a little bit about individual liability of corporate officers. You and FTC Commissioner Slaughter recently wrote dueling statements about individual liability. Can you share your views with the audience on individual liability and whether you think Commissioner Slaughter's approach would impact the ability of companies to recruit talent?
Sure. So the FTC is allowed to allege individual liability in a given case where we are seeking injunctive relief if a defendant participated directly in the deceptive practices or had authority to control those practices. And so if you're talking about a CEO, the CEO of a company almost always has the authority to control the practices that are at issue. And so essentially in every case, we could hold CEOs individually liable. That is not the approach that the FTC traditionally has taken. It has relied on its prosecutorial discretion to look at a variety of different factors, including, and most appropriately, whether naming the CEO is necessary to obtain full and effective relief and deterrence, or it could happen in a couple of different instances. So, for example, monetary relief. Is the CEO siphoning funds out of the company that are needed to provide redress for consumers? Or is the CEO essentially the alter ego of the company so that he could shut the company down and open another company and continue with his unlawful practices? And in those instances, we almost always name the CEO, and that is appropriate. But when you're talking about a well-established, legitimate company offering products that consumers want and need, it's a completely different story. And my concern is that if we tell CEOs, even the CEOs who are incredibly involved in compliance efforts, as they should be, and as was the case in Progressive, we're going to hold you liable because something happened on your watch. That creates a couple of incentives that I think we don't want to foster. First, you could have CEOs spending an inordinate amount of time on compliance issues to the exclusion of the core business issues. And that is not efficient. We want CEOs to send a message to the company, we will follow the law, and then have people around them who will implement that message. Second, if it's a company with a somewhat risky business or a lot of potential compliance risks, we could see very incredibly talented people with a lot of integrity who are disincentivized to go and work at those companies because they understand the risks. When in fact, those are the individuals we want at the helm of those companies. And so I do think Commissioner Slaughter's perspective would create the wrong kinds of incentives and in fact would lead to more problems in corporate America.
Okay, we just had an audience question about North Carolina Dental. So before moving on to privacy, I'm going to talk about North Carolina and the question about state regulatory regimes surrounding occupational licensing. As you know, some of these regimes limit worker mobility, paths to employment, especially for low-wage workers, women, military personnel, and military spouses. Indeed, recent research suggests that over 30% of jobs in the United States require a government license. What is your view on occupational licensing? Is the FTC working with states to help curb these regimes? And the audience question asks, in light of North Carolina Dental Board, is the FTC planning to bring additional antitrust cases against state licensing boards?
Great question. So Svetlana, obviously you know a ton about this topic. You helped former Chairman Olhausen with the Economic Liberty Task Force. I was a huge fan of that effort and remain a big fan and proponent of the FTC's competition advocacy work to break down barriers to entry that inhibit people from moving across state lines, from fully deploying their skills and their expertise. Now, obviously, states have an interest in protecting the health and welfare of their citizens, and it is appropriate that there are minimum standards. So, for example, I want a doctor who is licensed if the doctor is going to be conducting heart surgery or brain surgery. But the question is, are states sometimes essentially falling prey to incumbents who are seeking to do no more than erect barriers to entry that allow the incumbents to charge higher prices and to keep consumers from being able to exercise choice in terms of the provider that they'd like to seek? And I think when you look at the extent of licensing, you get a sense for how unnecessary a lot of these licensing regimes are. I think one of the favorite examples is hair braiders. And so you have to go to cosmetology school for more than 1,000 hours. You're not actually taught hair braiding. You're taught everything but hair braiding, including how to dye hair and all of these other things. And so you can't braid hair until you have an incredibly expensive cosmetology license that didn't teach you anything about hair braiding. On the other hand, if you are an EMT, you may have only 145 hours of training and you're dealing with people who've had heart attacks and gunshot wounds. And licensed security guards can carry loaded weapons with only 35 hours of training. And so there is a disparity. And a lot of it comes from incumbents who engage in rent seeking. And I would like to see states not fall prey to that. And the FTC has challenged in the past, and I believe should continue challenging inappropriate practices like this. And I would fully encourage Chairman Simons and the folks in the Bureau of Competition to look at these practices and to challenge cases where they to bring cases and challenge these practices where they can.
So one